I'm happy now to welcome back to the show Gene Henley. He's Associate Director of the School of Public Administration at the University of New Mexico, and Billy Blair, who's visiting lecturer there. And we're talking about a conference that's coming up this Friday, the 13th of January, at the Hotel Santa Fe here in Santa Fe. It's called Understanding the Budget and Pension Reform. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having us here today. It's a pleasure.
It's always good to have you back. So, understanding the budget and pension reform. By pension reform, what does that mean? Taking away state pensions?
As a state employee, I hope not. That's going to be one of the topics that is going to be before the legislature this year. It's probably not going to be acted upon, but it's going to be a topic of discussion. Pensions across the United States are a major issue, primarily in the public sector. And so what we hope to do in the afternoon session is to shed a little light on the topic from a variety of perspectives. We have some legislators involved. We have people that are involved in PARA, the New Mexico Educational Retirement Board, and a variety of different perspectives. So people who attend the conference are going to be able to ask questions, get some answers, and hopefully get a little bit better feel for the topic.
We also think, Mary Charlotte, that anyone who is getting a public employee pension, either a government employee or an educator, will be interested in this because they're going to hear some things they might not have heard before from some of our presenters on the panel.
Like about, what?
Well, we don't know yet.
But like what?
Well, about they're going to hear not just their prescriptive plans of how they might change pension eligibility, but their philosophy about what public employee pension should be. We anticipate that one of our legislators is going to say something along the lines of, why have public employee pensions?
So let's talk about what a pension is. Basically, you get paid your paycheck, and some money also goes into retirement account so that you can retire. That's what a pension is.
Well, in the New Mexico system, both the employee and the employer pay into it. That's something a little bit different than in the private sector nowadays. And so, for example,
Private sector, what happens?
Most of the time now, it's a 401k or 403 or some kind of permutation where it's primarily the employee's savings as opposed to contributions from the employer. So that's a big difference. Also, the amounts are different. In New Mexico, most state employees in the old days were able to retire after 20 years or 25 years at up to 80% of your salary of the high three. That's simply not something that you'll find very often in the private sector. So it's causing some tensions within, especially now in an economic downturn. You know, why is one group so advantaged over another one?
But of course, the salaries of public employees can't begin to match the private sector if you're working in anything resembling management.
That is certainly one of the topics that some people espouse. And some of these presenters are going to get into that level of detail. And regardless of what your philosophical or political concerns are, what really happens, to be quite frank, is how much is it going to cost? Can the state or can a municipality afford it? What you see happening in states, primarily California and some of the other back east, Midwest, are that the amount of unfunded liabilities is enormous to the point where it may well crowd out other programs. And so you're going to have a tension between existing programs and paying for, you know, these other obligations that are occurring.
And we have very large unfunded liabilities in New Mexico for public employees. It's $4.9 million, and it's $5.7 million for educators. It's unfunded.
What is an unfunded liability?
Well, the actuaries do their thing, and the amount that they project it's going to cost to pay pensions is one number, and then the amount that's actually coming in or that's in the bank, so to speak, is the other number. The difference between the two is the unfunded liability.
All of this, I think, has been contextualized by the Occupy movement, which is basically pointing out the vast inequality in our society. And it does raise the question of why public employees should be singled out as being some kind of, I mean, in the old days they used to say welfare queens or whatever, but being unfairly privileged in a world where everybody except the people at the top are having trouble making ends meet.
That's precisely what this is all about. At the end of the day, people are going to have to decide, the public as a whole are going to have to decide where they want to spend their money and what they want to spend it on. With an advancing age of a workforce, this is becoming more and more of an issue. Just last week in the Albuquerque Journal, there was an article about the number of people that had retired recently had spiked quite a bit, and that's in anticipation of both the possible changes that are going to occur, and of course we're just getting older. So those of us that are a little bit farther along in our careers, we're going to be watching this very carefully because it's going to have real immediate effect. Now, the same thing is also of concern to the younger people, because if these benefits disappear, then the incentive to want to work maybe in the public sector goes away. And they will go after, you know, the job with the bigger paycheck.
Well, and then you have the question of what quality of employee do you want to attract into the public sector?
Exactly. This is one of, historically in New Mexico in particular, we have a very generous benefits package, but that was used basically as an offset to the relatively low salaries on the front end. So you agree to work for less now in the hopes of making more, you know, when you retire. And so if the public changes that agreement, then one of two things is going to occur. And exactly as you mentioned, those that have other options may well consider those options and go to work in the private sector as opposed to working in the public. So we will face with a lesser quality employee.
I think there's so many different ways to approach these problems, and I'm glad you're having this conference. We're talking to Gene Henley and Billy Blair from the School of Public Administration at University of New Mexico about the upcoming conference called Understanding the Budget and Pension Reform. It's this Friday. One way is, what can we afford? Let's do that. Another way is, what's right and how can we afford it?
I'm going to suggest an additional way to look at it is, where do we want to invest? Okay, too often these things are looked upon as expenses, and much as you mentioned, getting better quality sometimes pays off in the long run. So I think that sometimes we should be looking at these things as investments in our future as opposed to just a cost item in a budget. But that's just one other point of view. There's going to be quite a few different perspectives that are going to be presented.
And the other thing that our participants are going to be hearing is, they're going to be hearing a report from Tom Clifford, who's the Secretary of the Department of Finance and Administration, on what the governor's office is recommending for funding, where they think the money should go during this next fiscal year that will start in July.
Do we know what she's recommending?
We hope to find out on Friday.
We're going to find out on Friday. That's why people should be there. And then we'll also hear the legislative perspective, because New Mexico is one of only four states in the union in which the executive branch and the legislative branch come up with separate budgets and then come together and hammer it out during
the
session.
Right, right. Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, if you have that sort of Republican perspective of cut government, but these are the state employees you're working with who probably won't be really thrilled if you cut their pensions. That's kind of a bind that I would think the governor's office would be in.
Clearly there's a conundrum at the moment, and one of the other challenges is that most state employees haven't received a pay raise of any kind for at least the last 3 years. And so the idea of scaling back on something else at the same time that there's no increase in compensation is problematic.
Right. Well, we can all find out more about this on Friday, the 13th of January, this Friday. It's a conference called Understanding the Budget and Pension Reform. It's at the Hotel Santa Fe starting at 8:30 in the morning, going until 4 in the afternoon. And how can people find out more information?
People can go online at dce.unm.edu, or they may call 277-0077. We also will be accepting registrations the morning of the conference at 8:30.
So people can just show up at the Hotel Santa Fe?
They can.
Billy Blair and Gene Henley from the School of Public Administration at the University of New Mexico. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Tom Crawford. His new book is called The Names of Birds. It's a book of poems, and he will be reading from the book and signing books on Wednesday of next week, the 18th of January at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here.
So you are what one might call a birder.
I am a birder.
What's a birder?
Well, they're a funny... actually, I have a poem that I could read about that describes a birder.
Excellent.
Rather than explicate my poem, I'll just read my poem. Birders, nationally, except for trappists, are quieter than the rest of us, lighter on their feet, too. What's odd is their uncommon excitement at just seeing a bird, rare or ordinary. Arms start waving and legs are inclined to wobble in some kind of gratitude. But if you think of them as species, these birders, they're not so endangered as the monks, but they are on the list of those most likely to become so, owing to their unguarded enthusiasm. Never mind, love them. They might just be our last best hope.
Tom Crawford. So this is a point of view that I don't see very often, because it's people who are not only obsessed with birds, but, I mean, you use them as a way to think about everything else in the world. And as I was reading the book, I felt like through your eyes, I'm seeing the world, I'm seeing bombs falling, human violence, and all of these things from the point of view of nature, from the point of view of birds, who, if they're thinking anything, are thinking, what are these crazy people doing?
Right, right. You know, this really began with my grandsons, Lael and Aiden, 10 and 13. A couple of years ago, when I realized that the world we were handing on to them was so diminished from the one I grew up in and played in. So that's how I got into the business of thinking more in an activist way about what we were losing. And I felt responsible, and I wanted to do something that was original. I'm not an ornithologist. I wasn't interested in birds in that way. I was interested in the human connection to birds in terms of the ways in birds and wild things empower us and make us feel whole and complete. So I was more interested in the mythology, a Joseph Campbell, you might say, approach to understanding the journey and the need for storytelling, which explores myth and a sense of wonder and a sense of potential, human potential. That's a long-winded answer, but it started with my grandsons. But another aspect of it was reading a piece of the New York Times years ago, and it was talking about endangered species, and I began to notice that the language, the scientific language, was so impersonal and unemotional. And I thought to myself at that time, I can do better than this. And I thought also, though I hadn't worked it out in my head yet, because I'd been working on this book now for 3 years, that what science can't give us is an emotional measuring of our world. And they can't quantify.
In fact, they strive hard not to.
Not to. And they, so the, since they can't quantify human feelings, they avoid them. And okay, that's all right for their sort of objective way of measuring things. But if you think of conservation and you think of how essential it is if we're going to try to save what's left, then you have to be a storyteller. It's only art that can do that. Science can't do that. So that was another motive. I wanted to write a book which really moved people in this way I've described. And nothing does that better than poetry. So.
Yeah, and again, you know, you have all these feelings when reading the book, and part of the feeling that I had was the poem as protest.
Yeah.
And then you think about the poem as protest, and then you think about the number of people. On the one side, the amount of craft and love that goes into each poem and in each line. And on the other side, the number of people who actually read poetry.
Yeah, you're bringing up the ancient struggle. Years ago, someone shared with me the idea that the problem we have, particularly have in America, is it's an ancient struggle between the mystic and the rationalist. The rationalist, i.e. the scientist, resents the mystic, i.e. the poet, because the poet or artist derived their power from a rational source. That makes the rationalist very uncomfortable. And you can't quantify it, makes him doubly uncomfortable. And we have that dichotomy in our culture, and that's why poetry suffers for an audience. When I lived in China and I lived in Korea, that wasn't true.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary. You could go into a bookstore in South Korea. What would be in the front of the store when you walked in? Poetry. The tradition there is Confucian, and poetry is like the top of the pyramid in terms of achievement with language.
And everybody respects their poets.
Yeah, and expect it. You think, oh my God, in China, if you're a poet, it's like, oh my God, that's wonderful.
Somebody was telling me that about Nicaragua also, that it's
absolutely
a country of poets.
Same thing.
Yeah.
I remember reading once about Nicana Parra, a South American poet, and he was a teacher at a university, and someone said, well, you know, the poets, when they have a poet, they provide a special parking place for his car or her car. So they don't have to struggle to big university. I thought, isn't that cool?
And here poets are lucky if they have a car.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We're talking to Tom Crawford about his new book, The Names of Birds. I was thinking about, I guess the title brings up a question for me, which is, what is gained from naming birds?
You mean literally the name?
Like what kind, not calling it Joey, but the kind of bird